Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Popes, Water and Rome. We delve back into the history of Rome and discover the key role past popes played in helping to ensure a constant flow of fresh, clean water through the aqueducts and fountains of the Eternal City. And minting and printing. We shine the spotlight on the long and fascinating history of papal coins and medals and Vatican stamps and examine some of the most famous and unusual examples from this rich heritage. The constant flow of fresh water through the aqueducts and fountains of Rome has been a characteristic feature of the city since its earliest beginnings. In the torrid heat of the summer, Romans and tourists alike are grateful for the abundance of fresh water that flows from these fountains and the hundreds of simple street taps throughout the city. But how many people are aware that had it not been for the vision and generosity of a succession of past popes, hot and thirsty pilgrims may have found it much harder to find a ready source of refreshing water whilst exploring the Eternal City. I've been finding out more about the key role a number of these popes played, both in ensuring a plentiful supply of pure water to the populace and in commissioning some of the city's most famous and beautiful fountains. My interviewee is Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University.
I think it's one of the most delightful things about Rome, the way that water is everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there's a water spigot or just a beautiful fountain. But that's part of Rome's history. When the first Romans settled on those seven hills, half the reason was because it was riddled with underground springs. There would never be a lack of fresh water in the city.
And I gather that during the Roman Empire, there were no fewer than 12 aqueducts supplying water to some 1,300 fountains. That's a pretty amazing feat when you think how long ago it was and how few people there were living in the city compared to now.
As a matter of fact, the population of Rome under the empire had 1 million. Now Rome has something like 3 million, which it has to supply water to. But the water supply of Rome grew as Rome did. So Rome started out using its cisterns, underground springs, and of course the Tiber water. But by 312 BC, there wasn't enough water for the burgeoning city on the hills. So the first aqueduct was born, thanks to Appius Claudius, which brought water 10 kilometers into the city. And from then, it grew and grew and grew to end up with a colossal 12 aqueducts.
But then I gather that during the Dark Ages, all that fell into disrepair. And the city turned to using water from the Tiber.
Apparently, on page 2 or 3 of the Barbarian Siege Manual, it suggests to break the aqueducts, and the result of that was to push all the people on the hills back down towards the plain, where they could be close to the only source of water left, which was that of the Tiber.
And how long did they carry on using the water from the Tiber then?
They used it for almost 1,000 years, until the papacies of the Renaissance.
And it was Pope Sixtus IV, I gather, who reconditioned the Aqua Virgo aqueduct in the late 1400s, and that was the start, wasn't it, of another sort of golden age as far as water is concerned.
Under many senses, Sixtus IV's pontificate was a golden age. The first man to span the Tiber with a bridge, the man who built the Sistine Chapel, and the man who repristined what was known as the best of all the aqueducts, the Aqua Virgo. Because the water from that aqueduct was always known to be the purest, the cleanest, the most limpid of all.
And I gather it's still in operation today, is that
right? Oh, yes, it is. The Aqua Vergine is still working today.
But it wasn't just this pope, Pope Sixtus IV, who did all this work. I gather that the successive popes also, they created new aqueducts, they brought more water into the city, built fountains. Can you tell us something about particularly this building of the aqueduct?
Oh yes, not exactly coincidentally. The next great aqueduct-building pope will be Pope Sixtus V, who is pope from 1585 to 1590. He built his own aqueduct known as the Aqua Felice, which means the happy aqueduct. But it actually refers to his first name, which was Felice. And he brought water in from the top of the Quirinal Hill and flooded the city, really revived the construction of the city so that the city would develop back along the Quirinal Hill.
And as far as we know, what prompted them to do this? I mean, was there a religious significance behind it, or was it really just an act of papal generosity?
Water to the city historically has always been connected with generosity. The Appius Claudius who offers this aqueduct, the Marcia family which offers another aqueduct, the emperor who would build an aqueduct. But when the papacy started to rebuild and repristine these aqueducts, yes, it is, again, an act of great papal generosity. It's an act of reviving and rebuilding Rome. But I don't think you can separate this use of water, this flow of water through the city, from that sense of the call to conversion, the sense of baptism, the sense of renewal, all of these implications that water has.
What do you think was the most outstanding in terms of the engineering work concerned, or maybe just in the amount of water that it supplied, if you had to sort of look at all these projects and pinpoint one of them?
If we're talking about the ancient Rome, by the time the empire is underway, by the 2nd century AD, the aqueducts were bringing 1 million liters of water into Rome a day. It was an incredible flow of water through the city. But without the same economic resources that the Imperial Rome had, without the same, even the manpower and slavery that ancient Rome had, without the same population and without the same ability to gather funds, Papal Rome managed to repristine all of these aqueducts and bring back this water that would flow through the city. So it's interesting to see how the underdog, in a certain sense, which was Papal Rome compared to Imperial Rome, was able to recreate that great generosity of water. If it hadn't have been for these really visionary popes, they did many other things. They were concentrating on water, but these popes also had a great vision of creating out of Rome the center of the church, a place where people would come from lands and cities where there isn't much water, or where there wouldn't be bridges, or it wouldn't be so well set out and laid out as a city. And you would come to Rome and you would see through the flow of the water, through the organization of the roads, through the well-constructed city, you would see the greatness of the heart of Christendom.
Now, a lot of this water was going to feed the fountains, and of course Rome is world famous for its fountains. How instrumental was the role of the papacy here in commissioning these fountains throughout the centuries?
There are 1,500 ornamental fountains in one way or another in Rome. About three quarters of them were built by the papacy. The popes created the particularly beautiful fountains are what is known as a show, and it's when the aqueduct first brings the water into the city. It's the moment that the water first emerges from the aqueduct and flows into its first fountain. And the shows are the ones that you know, the people know best. The Trevi Fountain is the show for the Aqua Vergine. The Moses Fountain on the top of the Quirinal Hill is the show for the Aqua Felice. And so they created these very big, beautiful fountains to celebrate the arrival of the water into the city. And then they were responsible for the cute little decorative fountains that would be in a corner of one street or tucked away into a piazza.
So let's take some of these famous fountains. The Moses Fountain, for instance, what Pope helped?
It was Sixtus V who ordered the construction of the Moses Fountain, and it's designed in the form of a triumphal arch. There are three arches, so again, the triumph of water, the arrival of water as it first emerges from the aqueduct. And the image shows Moses striking the rock for the water to leap forth, and then next to him there are these supplementary images of Aaron, the chief priest, and the people waiting for the water. And it's decorated in the front with four basalt lions, which were, at once upon a time, Egyptian lions, which are now in the Vatican Museums, but at the time they were lions that had been brought in from Egypt. And it makes a very kind of dramatic sense of triumph, which is a big part of this pontificate.
Now, of course, for most tourists, the Trevi Fountain is the most famous for a number of reasons. Can you tell us something about the papal role here?
Well, the Trevi Fountain starts as an ancient Roman aqueduct, is the show for the Aqua Vergine, which was built by the son-in-law and designated heir of Augustus, who was Agrippa in 25 BC. Now, that aqueduct, like all the others, fell into disuse, but it was legendary for the sweetness and the purity of its water. In the 1640s, Pope Urban VIII had the idea of getting people to move back onto the Quirinal Hill, moving away from the overcrowded area near the river. And he saw that Sixtus IV had already repristined the aqueduct. Water was already flowing into that area. But to create a kind of draw, he projected a very grand fountain for that show. And he started out by hiring none other than Gian Lorenzo Bernini. And Gian Lorenzo Bernini began by designing the square, not the fountain, so that the first thing that we all remember about the Trevi is the way we happened on it by surprise. I think everyone who's seen the Trevi Fountain remembers being kind of wandering through streets, wondering where this fountain is, and then the shock and surprise of encountering the fountain. And that was the work of Bernini. Now, the project then lay unattended to for almost 100 years. And it was just let go because it was too expensive, because it was too complicated, because there wasn't much interest. But between 1730 and 1740, the Corsini Pope decided to call up a contest to see who could come up with the best design. And Niccolò Salvi won the contest for designing the Trevi Fountain. Poor Niccolò Salvi didn't even live to see his fountain completed. It wasn't done until Benedict XIV's reign in 1762.
And Piazza Navona, of course, the Four Rivers Fountain there. Is there a papal link to this as well?
Well, that fountain is one of the most famous papal fountains of all. That fountain is, for art historians, it's the fountain that got Bernini back into papal graces, because there had been a big blow-up between Pope Innocent X and the artist Bernini in 1644, basically. Over the facade of St. Peter's, they were constructing a bell tower, and Bernini was in charge of the construction, and a crack formed in the facade of St. Peter's, and Innocent X, of course, was infuriated. There were a number of Bernini detractors who were ready to whisper in the ear of Innocent X, and Bernini had been sent away in disgrace from papal court. Now, in 1650, Innocent X wanted to build a fountain for what was essentially his front yard. The Pamphili Palace is the palace on the Piazza Navona that looks out over the Four Rivers Fountain. And he wanted a fountain that would combine an obelisk with this ancient Egyptian monument that were beginning to pop up all over the city. But at the same time, he wanted to bring water to the piazza out of that same generous appearance of the papacy. But everybody who presented projects to him presented the same thing, sort of an obelisk, a trough, the water. It wasn't very exciting. And the Pope was dissatisfied. Well, Bernini made a sterling silver model of the fountain that you see today, and he had it left in the Pope's apartments. And when the Pope came in and saw that model of the fountain, he said, "This is my fountain. This is the one. Who made it?" And when he heard that the artist was Bernini, he said, "Those who would not use the works of Bernini had better not look at them." And so Bernini was back in papal graces and constructing that wonderful fountain of the Four Rivers.
Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture in Rome. The history of papal coinage goes back nearly 1,300 years. And the coins struck often reflect the colourful and sometimes turbulent history of the papacy over the centuries. Since 1929, the Vatican City State has issued sets of commemorative coins and stamps several times a year that have become prized items for collectors around the globe. After the advent of the euro, the Vatican was granted the right in 2001 to issue its own euro coins. There is also a Vatican Philatelic and Numismatic Museum that attracts many visitors each year. Founded in 2007, the museum showcased the entire Vatican City State stamp and coin production from 1929 to present. Peter Jensis is a US numismatist who specializes in Vatican coins and also acts as a dealer for the tiny state stamps. He says the Vatican's commemorative stamp issues are always very popular with collectors.
Oh, there's a high level of interest in each new issue. I think the Vatican chooses its themes and its designs very carefully, often selecting special artists to do the work. And these stamps, of course, are available for sale at the Vatican itself.
So they're very much prized by collectors. And does that mean collectors all over the world, or is it mainly in the West?
Well, I think Vatican stamps pull in collectors from throughout the world. The U.S. maybe can be a little special. Germany certainly shows a lot of interest in the stamps of Vatican City. But as a special nation, it draws collectors from throughout the world.
What have been, to your knowledge, the most valuable or striking or unusual set of stamps ever issued by the Vatican that have really, you know, made their mark on history?
Well, the most valuable set of stamps is from 1934. And, in 1934, the Vatican took the original issue from 1929 and surcharged it with new values. This set is very rare and will run about $2,000.
Turning to the papacy's coinage, what are some of the most memorable and unusual examples of coins minted in the past centuries? Which are the most valuable examples? And who are some of the famous artists who designed them? Alan Berman is an expert in medieval and papal coins and author of two books on the subject, Papal Coins and Papal Numismatic History. He began by explaining to me why he became fascinated by the history of papal coins.
I was brought to papal coins as a teenager by three things. One, I am a great fan of the Middle Ages, and I see the papacy as being the most intact medieval institution that Western civilization has preserved. There are many, many medieval institutions, but the papacy is essentially intact. Also, I am a great fan of Baroque art and the papal coinage, and even architecture, for that matter, is just a wonderful sampling of Baroque art. The coinage of the Rome Mint, especially in 1600s, just beautiful. And lastly, and this is going to sound perhaps fairly trivial, I have since my childhood loved great big copper coins, and in the 16 and 17 and 1800s, the papal mint produced wonderful copper coins that looked like they could be milk chocolate candy bars.
But what are the earliest papal coins still in existence? Peter Jensis tells us more about when the long history of minting papal coins began.
That's a very good question. The coins of the Pope starts in the 8th century, and these earliest coins, sometimes they could be as simple as having the design of a cross on them. Later, they become more works of art, I think, certainly by the Renaissance, and so the papal mint has always used talented artists and engravers for their coins and medals.
Have there been any really famous names that have been used for this purpose?
Oh, well, no less an artist than Benvenuto Cellini made works for Clement VII in the 16th century, and Bernini would do so in the 17th century.
Now, on the front of a coin, there would usually be the bust of a pope. But what about on the reverse side? What have they included, you know, apart from presumably biblical scenes?
Yes, you're absolutely right. On the front or the obverse of the coin will often, most often, contain the name of the pope, certainly, and his year of reign. The reverse side, the popes did many things. They would use it for perhaps spiritual messages or to record their accomplishments.
Obviously, the election of a new pope was presumably the main prompter for minting a new set of coins. But what were some of the other notable reasons in the past centuries that spring to mind?
Well, you know, there are two major examples that come to mind. There's a special series of coins issued for each holy year or jubilee year. This occurs at least every 50 years and often more recently every 25 years. This would be the call for pilgrims to visit Rome and the holy basilicas. Now, the other special issue is the sede vacante issue. That stands for vacant seat. That's the period for which there is no pope, where the cardinals are in conclave looking to elect a new pope. For every period, coins and stamps are issued for that.
And I imagine those are very quickly snapped up, because obviously it's only a finite and fairly brief period.
Oh, absolutely right. Sometimes these periods can last less than 30 days. And in 2005, following the death of John Paul II, there was quite a interest in sede vacante issues. There were lines at the Vatican for the new issue of stamps.
Berman says the reverse sides of the papal coins are among the most varied and creative to be found on Western coinage. So in his view, what are some of the most striking designs?
One of the most inspiring coins is, in fact, the frontispiece of my book, Papal Coins. It's a 2.5 by oki piece struck in copper, which depicts St. Peter looking over his shoulder. At the same time, there were three different engravers' designs being struck. Two of them are in fact quite boring, but one shows what it was like to be Peter in the first century when you knew that you were one of the leaders of a cult that was illegal and could get you killed. It really gives a sense of urgency, and I really regret that with radio you cannot actually see it, but it depicts him having a concerned expression. He's looking over his shoulder. He is holding the keys to the kingdom as though he were guarding it from Romans that would desecrate it. It's very, very inspiring. Another coin is very, very recent. By the way, the piece I just mentioned is from the 1790s. Another very inspiring piece is from the 1950 Holy Year, and it has the Dove of Peace flying before the Dome of St. Peter's. Those two certainly would be very, very inspiring art.
Let's return now to Peter Jensis to find out which are his personal favourites among the past designs on papal or Vatican coins.
I recall a small silver coin from Pope Pius XI and Pius XII that shows St. Peter in a boat amidst a storm. And this is an ancient or a very old Christian symbol of the boat as the church, guided by God and providing a source of refuge.
So in other words, these designs are often reflecting or giving us an insight into the mood or the burning issues of the period they came from. So presumably when that was minted, the church was felt to be going through a stormy period.
Well, certainly stormy periods are not uncommon. I think also the period when the Pope started to lose a lot of the land they controlled within Italy. This is in the 1800s.
The popes didn't just issue coinage, but they also issued medals, medallions, didn't they? Can you give us some examples of some of those? I gather, for instance, there was even one issued when Vatican Radio was set up.
That's absolutely right. The medals have a special tradition and an old tradition. It starts in about the 1400s, and later there would be a tradition for minting at least one medal every year that we call the annual medal. That tradition continues today. The Vatican Radio Medal is a very beautiful medal. That's in 1931. The medal was issued commemorating the opening. In fact, the Pope gave a gold version of this medal to Marconi for his efforts.
And what does it show?
Well, it shows angels flying above the radio tower.
Okay, well, yes, of course, Vatican Radio's patron saint is the angel Gabriel, so that's very appropriate. Coming to the makeup of the coins, in the past, I gather they were generally minted in precious materials, at least for the larger values like silver or gold or else copper and bronze. But nowadays, how many are still made of silver and gold? Just the commemorative ones? Should we say the everyday coinage is usually nickel alloys now, isn't it?
That's correct. The modern gold coins from the Vatican and silver are commemorative coins. And they're intended for collectors, but the mintages are fairly low. For example, recent gold issues, Vatican only minted about 2,800 per year.
But what are the main reasons that prompt people to collect papal or Vatican coins in the first place? Is it quite often for spiritual reasons? Alan Berman again.
I would say that is the second most popular reason that people collect papal coins. I think that the first reason that people offer to me is the quality of the art. It's just wonderful art. Very often very inspired. It captures Renaissance art, it captures Baroque art, neoclassical, also very, very modern style artists, especially beginning with Paul VI. So the art really is the main feature that brings people into this field.
And which are the most valuable papal coins in existence? Let's go over once more to Peter Jensis.
Well, as you might guess, in the older coins and medals, gold, no surprise, tend to be the most valuable. And they're rare not only for their age, in many cases, but over the years, many coins and medals would have been melted, or there may have been some external factors. The French looted Vatican City around 1808, and no doubt many precious items were lost. As far as silver coins go, older coins can be quite large and have beautiful designs, as I mentioned, from famous artists. There's the coin of St. Peter that we talked about. There's one from around 1700, and a good example of this coin could cost $3,000 or so.
And when you say $3,000, is that the most expensive price for any papal coin, or are some of the prices even higher?
Oh, even higher. The gold coins and the gold medals can often run in the tens of thousands of dollars. That's no surprise, really, because in many cases there could be one or two examples of this coin that's or medal that survive.
I was speaking to Peter Jensis, a U.S. numismatist specializing in Vatican coins. And earlier you heard the voice of Alan Berman, an expert on papal coins and the author of two books on this subject.
If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies, but they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudato Jesus Christus.